This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's a pleasure for me to have on the show Glenn Greenwald, a chief blogger at Salon.com. Glenn Greenwald's the author of several books, including How Would a Patriot Act and A Tragic Legacy and Great American Hypocrites. Glenn Greenwald, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Great to be here. Thank you.
We're speaking a few days after the election on November 2nd, and I'm wondering what your takeaway from those results is.
I think the most amazing aspect of the outcome is that if you had looked at what happened after the 2008 election, you saw in the Republican Party a party that was so destroyed and collapsed that many people believed that it was essentially dead for the next many years, if not even decades or a generation. And if you were Barack Obama and you were inaugurated into office, and for whatever reason, just suppose hypothetically that he had vowed that his goal was to revitalize the Republican Party, to do everything he could to achieve that goal, I don't think he could have been as successful as he actually ended up being. I mean, it's really quite remarkable to watch a party that was that discredited just 2 years later sweep into office with such huge majorities. I mean, historic an outcome. You have to go back 50 years to find a party pick up that many seats, and it's really a remarkable failure on the part of the Democratic Party, who have squandered the goodwill and the support and the citizenry that in the last two elections they proved they could command.
So Glenn Greenwald, how is it that Obama did revitalize the Republican Party? What did he do wrong?
I think the central issue, of course, is the severe economic hardship and anxiety that is pervading the country. And what is interesting about it is there's no question that this began during the economic crisis of 2008 under George Bush. That was when John McCain famously announced that the election had to be suspended, that the debate ought not to go forward because the crisis was so severe that all good leaders have to focus only on that to the exclusion of everything else. And so Obama really had the opportunity when he was elected to come in and to be the voice for that populist rage and for that economic suffering that the entire country was experiencing, and to become the agent to lead the battle against the forces which were responsible, which was Wall Street and the economic elite in the United States that essentially own and control the political process. And he didn't do that. What he instead became was the agent for those very interests. And so rather than being the voice of populist rage, he became the target of populist rage. And the Democratic Party had no answers to give to the vast numbers of citizens who were feeling great amounts of fear and economic deprivation because they had sided with the very interests who were responsible. That left a vacuum for the right and for this Tea Party movement to come in and exploit it and manipulate it and to essentially assemble it against Obama. And ironically, the Obama who ran as the sort of agent of change just 2 years ago became the agent of the status quo and has suffered the backlash.
Why do you think Obama made that choice to side with the elite instead of take on the elite?
I think there's several reasons. I mean, one is if you look at Obama's history and the things that actually he described about his own tactics for success, he has definitely built his career by accommodating powerful factions rather than by confronting it. It's his personality. It's what he learned works for him. When he arrived in the Senate, the first thing he did was latch himself on to Joe Lieberman as his mentor and formed alliances with the centrists in the Senate rather than with progressives. So his instinct as a politician and as a person is to be accommodating to powerful interest rather than to confront them. At the same time, if you look at who funded his campaign, large amounts of his funding came from the very same Wall Street and corporate interests whose agenda he ended up accommodating and serving while in power. And I think that he perceived that his economic interests lay with keeping those elites on his side rather than having them perceive that he was their enemy. And I think finally, he believed wrongly, as it turns out, that the adulation that the Democrats and the progressives had for him would endure no matter what happened and no matter what he did, and that he need not attend to their concerns because at the end of the day, they would continue to support him enthusiastically, and that ended up not happening.
Mm-hmm. The one comment I remember from Obama on the on the Wall Street elite, on the bankers and their bonuses. I don't begrudge them their bonuses. And he said, this is our free market system. And these are some very savvy individuals. Wow, that is just not what the base wanted to hear.
Or it's not what the country wanted to hear when they were losing their jobs and having their homes foreclosed and watching Wall Street, who caused the problem in the first place, profit more than ever before, having the president essentially say, I don't begrudge them their continued prosperity. It's a zero-sum game when a country is suffering an economic crisis. And when a tiny sliver is prospering and the rest are suffering, the people who are suffering are going to take it out on the leaders.
And the Republicans were savvy on it. I saw some commercials by Republican candidates calling the Democrats the party of the fat cats and the party of Wall Street, which was a real switcheroo. What do you make of the most disturbing statistic I saw coming out of the elections, which was that 4 out of 10 voters have a sympathetic attitude toward the Tea Parties?
Well, I think, you know, that's unsurprising. For one thing, it's pretty easy to remain popular when you're an opposition party. I mean, we saw with the Democrats, for example, in 2006, not run on much of a platform. Essentially, they simply said, we're not George Bush and we intend to do things like end the war. And you just rail against the things that are unpopular. And it's very easy to maintain popularity. It's a lot harder once you're in power and you then have to actually enact policies that can be pinned to you. So the Tea Party was able to run on a platform of cutting government spending and getting the deficit and debt under control, which appeals to lots of Americans ever since Reagan convinced them that that was the key to national strength. And yet at the same time, they were never forced by the media or by anyone else to say what it is that they would cut. So now if they're going to be in power, they have one of two choices. They can either start to do things like cut defense spending and Medicare and Social Security, which will destroy them in 2012 if they do it, or they can essentially violate their promise by cutting very little, and then they'll be exposed as fraud. So I think the main reason that people are favorable towards them is because it's easy to be liked when you don't actually have to govern. But I think the real reason is that what unfortunately happens when you have a two-party system is that when one party is in control and people are dissatisfied with how things are going, the only alternative they have is to embrace the other party. And that's why you see such immense swings from 2006 to 2010. I mean, it isn't that the country loved Democrats in 2006 and 8 and suddenly decided they loved Republicans in 2010. It's that we have a very dissatisfied citizenry. And the only thing they can do when they're dissatisfied is to go back and forth between the two parties. And I think that's really what we're seeing more than anything else.
I'm speaking with Glenn Greenwald. He's a chief blogger over at Salon.com. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive. You're listening to Progressive Radio. What do you think Obama and the Democrats should do now?
Well, I think they're essentially going to do the opposite of what they ought to do. What they're going to do now is what Bill Clinton did after the 1994 midterms, which is at the advice of Dick Morris, is start to move to the proverbial center or even the right, start to try and accommodate Republicans even more than they've already been doing. The principal reason why the Democrats lost is because their base stayed home. And the reason their base stayed home is because their base saw very little reason to go out and vote for Democrats. And you cannot win elections if your base stays home. On top of that, if you don't actually do anything to alleviate the core problems that are causing people's dissatisfaction, you also can't expect to win elections. And I don't see any plan that the president has for doing anything about the massive unemployment crisis or the foreclosure crisis. And until he does that, I don't see how he expects to maintain his political standing.
Speaking with Glenn Greenwald of Salon.com, why don't you tell me a little bit about your background? I read that you're trained as a constitutional lawyer.
Right. Well, that's actually before I began writing politically, which I began in 2005. I was actually litigating essentially constitutional cases and defending constitutional rights, the First Amendment, the 14th Amendment, lots of civil rights cases.
Were you working with a nonprofit organization? Or were
no,
you
I was. Practice? I had out of law school joined a large firm, and then a couple of years later decided I couldn't bear that any longer, and so began my own firm that grew into a 10-person firm that did a lot of plaintiffs working in the constitutional and civil rights areas. And in around 2004, I really started perceiving that what George Bush and Dick Cheney and the administration were doing in the realm of civil liberties and the Constitution was really quite radical and dangerous for all the reasons that I'm sure people are familiar with, especially what really provoked my belief was the case of Jose Padilla when the Bush administration imprisoned a U.S. citizen on U.S. soil without any charges of any kind for several years and asserted the power to do so, which is part of an overall subversion of the Constitution, and decided that I could make a much bigger impact sort of joining the political conversation, writing about political issues, using my constitutional background to alert people to the extremism that was really taking hold of our political process more so than litigating.
Do you miss practicing law?
No, actually I don't in any single possible way. You know, our court system is really dysfunctional. Judges, with some rare exceptions, are fairly tyrannical, and the court system really is unable in lots of ways to deliver justice.
You're a huge success story in kind of the history of blogging. How did you go from being a lawyer to being a successful blogger?
Well, I think what ended up happening was is that I really began writing about a lot of issues that people were very interested in and yet was receiving very little attention in most establishment media outlets. There was very little discussion about what implications there were for these theories of executive power that the Bush administration had adopted, for the lack of accountability and the rule of law, which the president had immunized himself from. And so people were really actually quite hungry for a place that they could go to talk to one another about these issues, to learn about it, to read about it, to sort of have activism centered around it. And when I began writing about those issues, my blog just sort of organically grew into that kind of a venue, and it attracted a lot of readers in a fairly short period of time.
For a person listening in her car or in his kitchen or at the office who wants to drop what they're doing and become a blogger, what advice would you have for that person?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I think that there's lots of opportunities for people who have no background in journalism, who don't want to or can't work for large media corporations, to find a platform and a large readership. And that's one of the true revolutionary and hope-generating aspects of the internet. And, you know, essentially what I would suggest is that people go and just without any plan, not wait for the perfect opportunity, just go and create a blog, which they can do in about 10 seconds, and then just start experimenting with it and what the medium is, and writing about what they are actually passionate in. And anybody who finds a way to offer something unique that isn't being already offered, whether it's developing serious expertise in a particular area that's being neglected, or covering an issue that people are interested in that the media is ignoring, can really exploit the power of the internet and blogs to find a way to have their voice heard.
Speaking with Glenn Greenwald, of course, he's a big blogger over at Salon.com. He's the author of How Would a Patriot Act, A Tragic Legacy, and another book, Great American Hypocrites. You might have seen him on Rachel Maddow. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. This is Progressive Radio. Let's get to some of the substance of what you've been writing primarily about over the last 5 years, and that is this assault on civil liberties, which is a subject dear to my heart. And you mentioned the theories of executive power, the extravagant theories that Bush and Cheney promulgated. What has Obama done with those theories?
Well, mostly what he's done is embraced them and entrenched them further, and in some really disturbing cases, expanded them. And what's interesting is that, you know, Obama ran not with these issues of civil liberties and the rule of law as kind of a side or secondary or ancillary issue. He really featured them as part of the centerpiece of his campaign, the restoration of the rule of law, a reversal of the Bush-Cheney war on terror architecture. And one of the things that has been most disappointing and even angering to me and a lot of other people has been the complete betrayal of that platform. You know, the issue is not that he hasn't reverse these things quickly enough. The issue is that he has affirmatively embraced them and made them his own. And so, you know, you look at things like the state secrets privilege, which was a weapon that the Bush administration distorted wildly to prevent courts from examining allegations that they broke the law by saying that what we did in this area is too much of a secret for you to look at. Candidate Obama railed against that as a tool of tyranny. President Obama has repeatedly invoked that same theory to prevent courts from looking at allegations of torture and warrantless eavesdropping, rendition and the like. You look at putting people into cages without any due process of law. Candidate Obama had said that that was something that was unconscionable to do. President Obama has continued preventive detention at Guantanamo with no charges or trials of any kind. He argued that to an appellate appellate court, that people who he abducts and brings to a war zone in Afghanistan and imprisons at the prison in Bagram have no right of habeas corpus. You know, you go down the list and then you look at other things such as a new program invented by Barack Obama, which is that he has compiled a hit list of American citizens and ordered the CIA to track them down anywhere that they are found in the world and to kill them far away from a battlefield without due process of any kind, which to me is really the sort of core expression of what an authoritarian power is. It's something that we learn in when we're children, that what makes the United States great is that we can't be punished by our government without being charged with a crime and convicted and tried. And so these are areas where he's not only entrenched those policies, but in some sense expanded them.
And had Bush asserted the right in public of going assassinating a U.S. citizen wherever he found them, if he considered them, you know, an enemy on his own, you know, just on his own judgment, you think that liberals, Democrats, progressives would have just been up in arms. But this is, other than the Center for Constitutional Law and the ACLU, there's been, and you're writing, there's been very little discussion of this, or
well,
much less
that, protest. You know, you're right about that. And actually that's, you know, it's very disturbing, but also quite dangerous. It's disturbing because during the Bush years, those of us who were making this the focal point of our work received nothing but widespread support from Democrats and progressives, and it was the standard Democratic line that Bush was shredding the Constitution and waging war on civil liberties. I mean, this was, as I said before, a centerpiece of Obama's campaign. This was something that that liberals and Democrats pretended to care greatly about, and yet now that you have a Democrat in the White House pursuing exactly the same policies, you either find complete indifference and silence over these things, or worse, active support. You know, I've run into justifications all the time being offered by progressives for these kind of things. But what makes it worse than that, even just the complete lack of principle, is the fact that what happens in our system of government is that when it was just George Bush and Dick Cheney pursuing these policies, at least then there was a lot of divisiveness over them. There was debate over it because it was perceived as a right-wing Republican policy, and it was constantly debated and talked about. But then when you have a Democrat who comes into office and embraces the same policies, it no longer is a right-wing Republican policy that causes divisiveness. It then becomes bipartisan consensus. And then it then is removed from the scope of mainstream debate, and it essentially just becomes the tacit assumption that the president has these powers and that our government will do these things. And that's why, ironically, Obama hasn't just continued these policies, but he's strengthened them by making them the policies not of the Republican Party, but of the entire political class.
So it's no longer aberrant. It's part of the structure of executive power at this point.
Precisely.
You have a theory for explaining why Democrats have and their supporters have gone silent on this. This is a theory of political tribalism. Do you want to explain that?
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, one of the ways, the principal ways that our political discourse is shaped is by allegiance to one of the two sides, almost the way that in a football game you have rabid fans of one team or the other who go and give their unconditional support and loyalty to their team. They cheer for their team. They boo the other team. And essentially that's what our political discourse has come to resemble, so that there you don't have political principles where somebody says, I believe that this policy is dangerous, and I therefore criticize vehemently any politician who pursues this policy. What you have instead is a tribal allegiance that says that whatever the other side does is inherently wrong, whether I agree with it or not, and whatever my side does is inherently right, and I agree with it or not. And you see this mentality express itself in all kinds of ways, so that people who were criticizing the Bush administration quite vehemently and then applied the same criticism to Obama are often accused of being disloyal or helping the Republicans to win by committing the crime of criticizing one's own side. And that's the mindset of a tribalist, of a partisan loyalist, and not a citizen who's exercising their own thought independently.
And to have citizens exercising their own thought and exercising power, really, democratic power with a small d, do we need to do something to this two-party system? And if so, what?
I don't think there's any question that the two-party system is doing nothing but perpetuating the status quo and all the things that we claim to oppose. And it's what's the last 2 years, or really the last 4 years, have made abundantly clear is that simply changing party control in Washington doesn't change very, very much. The same factions that continue to reign will have their way no matter what the outcome of elections are. It matters in only the most marginal and symbolic ways. The problem, of course, is that things like supporting third-party runs and the like have become so stigmatized, largely as a result of what happened in 2000 with Ralph Nader, and even more so because the parties want them to be stigmatized. I mean, the last thing parties want is for anyone to think about all options that exist outside of the two-party system, that it's very hard to assemble enough of support for it that it can matter. And then you have structural barriers, so that it's very hard to have a Republican or Democrat be viable, or non-Republican or non-Democrat be viable, unless it's someone like Michael Bloomberg, who can spend $2 billion of his own money. And I'm not going to be that excited if a billionaire is the one who subverts the two-party system. So we do need alternatives for sure.
Speaking with Glenn Greenwald of Salon.com, I'm Matt Rothschild. This is Progressive Radio. There's one thing that you've said that I disagree with, and that is that you believe the concepts of left versus right are kind of obsolete. It seems to me that those are still very legitimate and illuminating theoretical constructs and also organizing constructs. To me, the basic point is corporate power and also imperialist U.S. foreign policy.
Right. I mean, there's no question that left versus right has coherent meaning in the sense of on the level of political theory, so that you could define what conservatism is and what political liberalism is in a way that's meaningful and quite different. But what I really mean by that is that there are lots of issues that really don't lend themselves to pure left-right dichotomies. You saw, for example, lots of anger and opposition over government policies that lent $800 billion to bailing out Wall Street. You saw that on both the left and the right. You see anger over corporate control of Washington over on both the left and the right. I think you are starting to see a questioning of America's imperial policy in the world on both the left and the right. And well, and sometimes you even see civil liberties being joined by both parties. Ron Paul, for example, is a civil libertarian. Bob Barr, the former Republican congressman, endorsed Russ Feingold on those grounds. But what I think more so is more so important about that is that a lot of time these left-right disputes are really used to divide people who have more common interests than different interests. So you have lots of ordinary Americans who are at each other's throat over things like social issues, things that Washington usually does very little to change. And yet what it does is it keeps the citizenry divided, ordinary Americans divided, who ought to be joining together against these very narrow elites who continue to use the power of government to promote their own interests. And I do think that there are conservatives, people who self-identify as conservatives and people who self-identify as liberals, who are being oppressed economically in the same ways by the same people who, if they could see past the sort of less significant divisive issues, would have far more in common politically than they realize.
Glenn Greenwald, you've made it outside the mainstream corporate media, and I'm wondering what your critique is or your observation is about the role the corporate mainstream media plays in this country.
They play an enormous role because the reality is that even though the technologies that we discussed earlier enable people to find platforms and build platforms and to speak without constraints, the vast majority of Americans continue to get their information largely from the same set of small corporations that own the largest and most dominant media outlets. And within those media outlets, there are a very narrow range of opinions that are even heard and aired, let alone supported and amplified. And so what it does more than anything else is it gives the appearance of being that there is this free-flowing, free debate that takes place in the United States. But what it does more than anything else is it excludes a whole variety of views that actually a lot of Americans hold and that belong in the public discourse, but that most Americans never end up even hearing. That's what it does more than anything, is it's like a gatekeeper to what people are exposed to.
And the biases can you've detected pretty cleverly, Glenn Greenwald. I saw an article you wrote or a post you put up on the way the New York Times treated the WikiLeaks Iraq document dump. Explain the distortion that the New York Times engaged in.
Well, I think a lot of people tend to talk about media bias in terms of whether or not it's pro-Democratic or pro-Republican. Of course, Fox News. Right, or Fox News is sort of the epitome of bias. But the reality is, I think, a little bit different, which is that most establishment media outlets, and that's the term I prefer for them, establishment media outlets, because it reflects really what they do, which is they are essentially allies of those in power. They amplify what the people in power want to be disseminated. That's their true allegiance, and that's their true loyalty for a whole variety of reasons. And so you see that with the New York Times. You, of course, that's always accused of being, you know, the liberal New York Times, the left-wing New York Times. And of course, the New York Times did more than any other media outlet in the world to convince Americans to support the war of aggression in Iraq. And yet that didn't interfere in any way with this idea that the New York Times is the sort of head point of the liberal media. And with this WikiLeaks leak, one of the things that you saw was that the New York Times took the revelations that were trumpeted around the world that were so disturbing about these documents, including the fact that there were huge numbers of civilian deaths that had previously been uncounted, that contractors like Blackwater were responsible for the reckless numbers of Iraqi civilians in all kinds of ways that we hadn't previously known about, and most of all, that the U.S. systematically turned a blind eye to Iraqi torture right under our noses and basically imposed a limit that we would not even investigate that abuse. The New York Times took those revelations and really downplayed them, if not whitewashed them completely, and instead played up sort of more government-pleasing revelations, including the fact that Iran was active in Iraq, which is hardly surprising, given that Iran is a bordering country of Iraq and has lots of interest there. And most of all, what they did was they promoted as prominently as any other revelation a very kind of gossipy smear piece about Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, that made all kinds of speculations about his mental health and his state of mind that was completely irrelevant to the most historic war leak since the Pentagon Papers. It was really a way of distracting attention away from that leak. But that's what the New York Times does, is they serve the interests of the American government.
And as far as terminology goes, they ran away from the word torture, you said.
Right. I mean, they actually have an official editorial policy at the New York Times that Bill Keller, the executive editor, was forced to defend, where the word torture is barred from usage whenever it comes to official American policy. So even though the tactics and techniques that we know were authorized by the Bush administration, including waterboarding, have been characterized as torture by American courts, international law, the consensus of Western civilization for many decades, because the Bush administration insisted that it wasn't torture, the New York Times took the editorial position that to be neutral, it would not call torture torture. They still do call other countries' tactics that are identical torture, when Iran does it, when North Korea does it, when Soviet dissidents die, they'll use the word torture. But the same exact tactics suddenly become something other than torture when the United States does it. And in that case, in the WikiLeaks case, when the Iraqi forces that we support did the most brutal and inhumane things possible to helpless detainees, they also refrained from using the word torture. That indicates what the true bias of the New York Times is.
And what was their excuse for this? And the official policy?
The official policy was justified by Bill Keller and others as being that as journalists, we should not take sides in disputes. And since there is a dispute underway about whether this is torture, the Bush administration says it isn't. Others say that it is. It's not for us to take disputes, take sides in that dispute. Now, one would think that the role of journalists is to say what is factually true. There's a dispute over whether the world is round. Some people say it's flat. Some say it's round. You would expect the United States, the New York Times, and good journalists to say that it's round. You'd expect them to call torture torture as well.
Well, we only have about 15 seconds left. What advice do you have to a listener who wants to read beyond this corporate establishment media?
I think that they ought to listen to public radio and alternative shows like the one that they're hearing now. I think they ought to go on the internet. There are millions of blogs, literally, that are written by their fellow citizens, and they ought to search for the ones that are reliable and credible.
Terrific. Glenn Greenwald, it's been great having you on Progressive Radio. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.